Tonight on Arena, travel to Venice by book with Cullum Tobin as your guide. And will With Neil and I help you get through lockdown? #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And nice to be back with you after discovering how many more places are 20 kilometres from where I live than I knew a week ago. I hope you're all managing with lockdown still, and thanks to Care for doing the job for me last week. The Wexford Festival Opera launched its 2020 programme today, and as you can imagine, it's a very different festival from the one we're used to. But it is a festival nonetheless, and it will take place from October the 11th through until the 18th of this year. I'm delighted to be joined from Pesaro in Italy by the Artistic Director of Wexford Festival Opera, Rosetta Cucchi. And Rosetta, you're calling it Waiting for Shakespeare. A bit of a mixed bag of writers in there. A festival in the air. Yes. Explain that title.
Yes, exactly. Hi, Sean, and thank you for having me. Yes, as you remember, the last time we spoke, I spoke about the Shakespeare in the Heart, the festival that was my first festival I was supposed to have in September, October. Now, unfortunately, we have to move this festival on 21. So I thought about your Beckett. I thought about Waiting for Godot. And we are waiting for Shakespeare. Now, Godot never arrived. Shakespeare will arrive for sure. So this is not only hope, but a sureness. And it's called also the festival in the air, because it will be all over. And I remember an old song that was done, Music in the Air, and this is the festival in the air. Yes.
Ah, right. A little hark back to that childhood memory from any, the Walking in the Air, the Snowman song. I was looking at one of your publicity, a thing you did on YouTube just about the upcoming programme, Rosetta, and one of the first things that you say in that address from you on YouTube is, we will have a festival. Was there any time when you doubted the possibility, when you thought, we're just going to have to let this go and we're just going to have to wait and have a new festival again in 22 and that's it?
I mean, as you can imagine, in this moment, especially in the past months, it has been very, very tough for every company, from every artist. It has been a moment where we said, what can we do? What really can we do? But our willing was to not go on dark this year. The festival has to survive even in a different way, but it has to survive, because it has to be a sample, a template for everybody else, that we can do it. Somehow we can do it. And this terrible virus made us understand that we can do something with what we have. I said to all my colleagues, all my people in Wexford, let's make virtue of necessity. This is what we need to do.
Yes, and hence that little added bit in the title, A Festival in the Air, because the majority of the events will not have audiences. We'll talk about ones where you're hoping there might be some facility for an audience. We'll talk about that in a second. But the majority of the material will be available only online, and that it's in the air. Therefore, you can be sitting at home watching it on your computer or wherever you choose to do so.
Absolutely. I mean, paradoxically, this festival will be much wider than all the other festivals, because everybody will be able to see it. Of course, if we can, we will allow some public, because for artists, public is mainly important. So if we will be able to do it, we will. Meanwhile, as we say, meanwhile is a very important word. In the meanwhile, we will put everything online and everything will be ready for our public. Yes. Of course, we will have artists in Wexford. So we will be on stage. This is important. It's not just an online recorded old opera. No, this is something that we will really make on stage. So we wanted also to give the chance to the young singers, to the young artists, and to the let's say young old friends and new friends, I always say. So new friends, the factory will be there, and they will be in Wexford. Old friends, all the singers that has been in Wexford before has accepted to sing for us a gala in remote. So we will have new friends and old friends all together in Wexford.
Yes, that gala in remote, that's a lovely way of putting it, a gala concert in remote. And when you start thinking about, in fact, the, I suppose this necessity has given you an opportunity to actually invent something new in some ways. You will manage to have singers singing at the gala concert remotely, I accept that. But singers who would not have been able to come to Wexford because of other engagements, or they couldn't have just come to do the gala concert. So in fact, you can probably give us a gala concert there, which will be on Friday the 16th of October. You can give us a gala concert there with a variety of material that you just would not have been able to do with the actual event. You wouldn't have had these people in Wexford.
Absolutely. I mean, when I started to pick up my phone and call all these people, you know, that are superstars now, but they have been in Wexford before. Wexford has been their springboard. So somehow they are so attached to Wexford. Mm. And, you know, we have a great feeling about that, that all of them said yes. So I started with Joseph Calleja, Juan Diego Flores, Angela Mead, Daniela Barcellona, all the superstar system of singers. And, you know, and I was so surprised every time they said, oh, yes, Rosetta, for you, for Wexford, with pleasure. And this has been something amazing, you know.
Really the other thing, amazing. Yes, it is extraordinary that you can get it. Well, I know that you have a long association, particularly with Juan Diego Flores, the Peruvian tenor, and that he will be part of your masterclass events in Wexford as well. So that's very exciting that he will actually be physically present and people will be able to watch that online as well.
Hopefully, yes.
But I'm interested in this idea that perhaps, and I know this all depends on what the guidelines you are given will be at the time of the performance in October, that perhaps people will be able to attend, people will be able to present. Am I right in thinking, is it today in Italy that theatres, are theatres starting to open back up? So
exactly.
How are they doing that? How are they doing
it's
that?
It's fantastic. So today, at midnight last night, a lot of theatre reopened. The minute after midnight, all the theatre in Italy reopened with concert, with little things. Of course, we are under social distancing, of course. Mm. But this has been a great relief. And you cannot imagine for artists what does it mean reopen that doors. Smell again. The smell of the theatre is something that an artist cannot live without. And today is the day. The last time we spoke, I was in lockdown, in a big lockdown, without the possibility to go within 200 meters from my house. Now Italy has gone out of this. The lockdown is over. Everybody wear masks. Everybody are very careful, but everything has been opened again. I wish in Ireland it will be soon the same, because the breath of freedom that we are breathing now is something incomparable.
Well, I sincerely hope, though, the wonderful singing from the balcony that you described to me when we last spoke, I hope that hasn't stopped. Where were you last night, by the way? Did you go to a local theatre to be part of all of this?
Yes. I was in our Teatro Rossini to see a small show by an actor and a guitar player. And it was beautiful, you know. Mm. Even if it was small, the idea of attending of something was amazing.
Right. Okay, I'll tell you, I want to finish up with a little bit of Rossini, suitably enough, seeing as you were in the Rossini Theatre last night. And this is a very special event that you're organising around. It'll be a performance of the Little Solemnmass, the Petite Messe Solennelle of Rossini. Explain that work to me and we'll maybe finish up by listening to a little bit of it. How are you going to realise it in Wexford?
I mean, this will be the first event of the week in Wexford. And As I said, it's a joint venture between Ireland and Italy. We will have an Irish quartet because we will have Claudia Boyle, we will have Tara Rao, we will have John Molloy, and we will have an Italian tenor called Pietro Adaini, which is a very Rossinian tenor. Now, we will do the original version of Petite Messe Solennelle, which is for two pianos, harmonium, four singers, four soloists, and 12 cherubs, as Rossini said. So who will be these 12 cherubs? Are the singers of our factory. So everything will be done in Wexford. And what we wanted to do, we wanted to dedicate this piece, which is a masterpiece, to the victim of the COVID, because even if the theater will reopen, even the society will be again as they were, we will never forget what has happened in this period.
We don't have to forget. No, we certainly don't. And I know that also you're going to give us a Falstaff. We'll get a nightly episode of that, 15 minutes a night, a bit like a Netflix version.
Yes, exactly.
And the Rape of Lucrece with three different endings. Now, I'm really looking forward to seeing how that's going to work. Lovely to speak with you again, Rosetta. I'm delighted that things are lifting for you there, and hope that we will get to see you face to face, hopefully, in the period of the festival itself
this
year.
We will, for sure. And stay with us. Thank you very much.
That's Rosetta Cookie, the Artistic Director of the Wexford Festival Opera, Festival in the Air this year, which runs from October the 11th through until the 18th. WexfordOpera.com will give you all of the details. Let's finish up with a little bit from that Petite Messe Solennelle of Rossini with the Sinfonica di Galizia conducted by Alberto Zeda. Kyrie from the Petite Messe Solennelle of Rossini with the Sinfonica di Galizia, conducted by Alberto Zeda, and that will be part of this year's special reimagined Wexford Festival Opera, the 11th through to the 18th of October. WexfordOpera.com for full details there. And by some quirk of fate, we're managing to keep Wexford and Italy together in the next item as well. Tonight we start a new series by way of some virtual tourism for those of us confined to barracks. What's better than being on holiday or a mini break in a beautiful city and then having a perfect classic book that relates to that place to read? So for the next few weeks, we're asking some eminent cultural commentators to pick three books set in a particular place. We begin tonight with the Wexford part of the equation, the author of Brooklyn, The Master, Mad, Bad and Dangerous to Know, Colm Tobin, who's joining us from LA, but his choice is the Italian part of the equation, probably the most romantic and atmospheric city of all, Venice. And great to be speaking with you this evening, Colm. I remember the first time I ever went, first time I visited Venice, I had such high expectations. I thought to myself, it will never live up to this, these expectations. I'm going to be disappointed and I'm going to go home with my tail between my legs. It didn't disappoint at all. It went beyond my expectations, which I thought was practically impossible. What has made it, do you think, such a source for artists throughout the centuries, Colm?
I think the fact that the glory has faded and that there's a crumbling feel to the place, an isolated, lonely feel to the place. And then on the other hand, there's the astonishing splendor. There's a beautiful St. Mark's Square. But then when you move away from St. Mark's Square, as I think it becomes very clear, say, in Ian McEwan's book, The Comfort of Strangers, where no map will work because there are too many tiny streets, too many side streets. So you can never use a map. So you get lost all the time. If you get lost, you then go down a street, which is a cul-de-sac, and you suddenly realize you're in this eerie, strange, silent, if it's night, you don't know who could come, you don't know how, the only way to go is directly back, but then immediately you lose yourself again. And Henry James went there quite early in his life, and then he set his novel in the early years of the 20th century, the novel The Wings of the Dove, in the city, and it is where Millie Thiele, who's dying, she rents a palace in Venice, and as the novel says, she turned her face to the wall. And the novel also says she would have done anything to have lived. But it is that idea of associating Venice with death. Interestingly, that Henry James stayed in the Palazzo Barbaro in Venice, just at the Academy Bridge. And the library of that house, which is owned by the Curtises, that library is still intact. They used to make a bed for him there. And a few years ago, I got into that building and I went into the room and said, but that's because I'd seen photographs. And also his description of it is still there, intact, untouched from the time James stayed there in the 1880s, 1890s. Thomas Mann's wife wrote memoirs when she was in her 90s called Unwritten Memoirs. And she described going to Venice with her husband and her brother-in-law in 1911, just after the death of Gustav Mahler. And Mahler had been a friend of theirs. He was on their minds. And Thomas Mann on the beach, she says, she was a very liberal woman. She said, yes, he started to look at this boy on the beach. That happened. So then he wrote his Death in Venice, describing this German intellectual, this German romantic figure, isolated bachelor, arriving in Venice on his own to stay in that hotel on the Lido, and suddenly begins to watch this boy and becomes completely obsessed with him, follows him on the streets at the same time as cholera, as their pandemic is arriving in the city. So the whole idea of mixing in obsessive love with death. And that was also what happens in The Wings of the Dove, that Merton Densher, who is meant to be in love with the dying woman, but in fact wants her, and I'm giving the plot away, but in fact wants her money, that he turns up in Venice and he sits in Florian's, which I think is now 300 years old this year. Florian's being still there as the cafe. It's quite an expensive cafe, but it's beautiful. In St. Mark's Square, he sits there and he sees his rival through the window in this city. So cavernous. He sees his rival walking by Lord Mark and he realizes that his sort of case is lost. The McEwan book is creepier. It's almost like Don't Look Now, the Daphne du Maurier, where you can never tell in Venice what street you're in. And this means that the two innocent English people arriving in McEwan's novel suddenly find that they're lost and suddenly find that somebody takes them in, and that person becomes, and his wife become creepier and creepier. And the two English people, you know, they go to the beach, they walk the streets, they realize that restaurants close, which they do still in Venice very early. And if you miss them, you don't get anything to eat. But I think it's that idea of the city as a place that's fully alive, that almost has claws, that has wings, that has so many different elements of, for example, large squares you suddenly walk into that are fully beautiful with about 10 different exits, none of which you're sure of.
You sound the way you, now you've given us the three books that essentially would be your way of getting into the atmosphere of Venice within that answer there. Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, Ian McEwan's The Comfort of Strangers, and Henry James's The Wings of the Dove. But you speak as somebody who has got lost up a few side streets in Venice more than once. Is it a city you have visited regularly? Is it a place you like to revisit time and time again, Colm?
Yeah, I've been going there for more than 40 years. And I've become sort of an intrepid tourist. There's a thing you can buy, a single ticket. And that single ticket will get you in free to about 14 churches. And they give you a map, and then you can start off, and you know you can do the Frari, you can do San Rocco. There's an amazing small museum or space where you can see the Carpaccios, and you can just become this really good tourist. You know, instead of just sitting around watching everybody or just you know getting lost, you can actually become dedicated and serious. Joseph Brodsky, the Russian poet, has a very good book, a little book on Venice. I think of the guidebooks, Jan Morris's book, Venice, is probably the best. Joseph Brodsky's book is called Watermark, but he says something marvelous. He says, Venice won't come twice. You know, that New York has been replicated in various other cities, including in Asia. that idea of the skyscrapers, the island, and all of that. But Venice won't come again in the world. So when you go there, you realize this is a blip in history. It's a flaw almost. The idea that they have to build on an island, the idea that they built with such splendor, the idea of the palace, and the idea also of the sort of extraordinary connection to the Byzantine, the way in which St. Mark's, the church itself, does not look like a Western church, but it looks like something much further east, because of course Venice was the gateway to that.
I wasn't surprised, Colin, when I saw that Henry James was, of course, on your list. A writer with which you have a very close affinity, not least because of your own fictional account of him in The Master. The Wings of the Dove, how representative is that of James's work, would you say?
They say that it's James the First, James the Second, and then the Great Pretender. In other words, that his style became, I suppose, more nuanced and more elaborate and more difficult in a way when he wrote his last three novels. There's an extraordinary moment in the history of the novel where in 1901, 1902, 1903, 1 year each, Henry James wrote these very big books, The Ambassadors, The Wings of the Dove, and The Golden Bowl. And The Wings of the Dove is an extraordinarily beautiful story. It's this heiress who's dying, comes from America to Europe. And she just wants, in a way, to have a last fling, a last look at life. And she meets this young man without realizing that he himself is entangled with a woman called Kate Croy. And they have no money. And they realize what they can get if her fortune could come their way. But they do it very, very subtly. I mean, it looks almost in the end as though it was, that they're not necessarily bad people. Mm-hmm. They just were put in the... James is very good on what people will do for money. And the answer is quite a lot. the extraordinary scenes then when she comes to Venice, moving into this palace where James himself has stayed, and the idea of the city as both splendid and crumbling sort of matches the idea that she wants this to see the most beautiful place in the world, but at the same time, it's where she will turn her face to the wall.
And this is typical too in James. Is it fair to say that he gives us, we get it in Portrait of a Lady as well, this idea of not so much the innocent American, but the American perhaps with a real sense of you behave properly, you've a sense of fair play, you do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. And perhaps a more cunning type of attitude on the part of the Europeans in the case of The Wings of the Dove, Kate and Densher kind of manipulating things in the hope that they'll get the money at the end of it all.
Yeah, I think it isn't just that his American heroines are innocent, but they are, but they also want something from life which isn't just material. They don't just want rank. They don't just want to marry a duke. They want something large from life, which has been, in a way, delineated by Emerson and Thoreau and those American philosophers who talked about self-invention or self-creation, that they want something urgent and pressing from life. And that's what she comes to Europe for. And she presumes, because they have the same manners as she does and the same sort of relationship to style, that they too have her own sort of moral compass, which, of course, they don't.
Yeah.
And she misunderstands them. And that's the drama of the novel. It's the drama also of The Ambassadors. And it's the drama also of The Golden Bowl. So in those three last big books of his, he dramatized that conflict between some sense of an ideal, people having an idealistic view of life and people having a material view of life.
Well, if James is the master, then Thomas Mann is the magician, which is in fact the title of your new novel, which will be about Thomas Mann, I believe, called the magician.
Here, which is the master becomes the magician, and that episode in Venice is something that I dramatize in the book. Where it's an extraordinary idea that this famous German writer goes with his wife and his brother to Venice, sits on a beach, and in front of them, while they understand what he's doing, he starts to ogle, he starts to stare this boy. And becomes obsessed with him, and then he writes the story, and the story is more or less autobiographical, although he gives Mahler some of his own characteristics. He mixes himself in with Mahler, but of course Venice is absolutely tailor made for the early Ian McEwan style, which is macabre, which is very interested in the creepy business of anything that's near water for McEwan will always have rot, creepiness, death, violence, fear. And so The Comfort of Strangers, it's a short book. Actually, I read it again yesterday. I hadn't read it since it came out in the early 80s, but it really holds up. He makes the two English characters very clear to us. And so they too are sort of innocent. They're on their holidays. They think Venice is a nice place to be, not realizing that in one of those strange, narrow, cavernous streets with the dim lights, they're going to meet their nemesis. And he strings this out very beautifully in the book. He doesn't name Venice.
Yeah.
It's an unnamed city. It's absolutely clear. It's absolutely clear that they're bad map readers because they're bad maps.
Well, as you say yourself, it's hard to get a good map of Venice.
Don't try. The only solution to that, by the way, is not to try. Just don't go near a map. Just say you're going to go wrong all the time and turn back and, you know, try the next corner and see if the restaurant will be there. But the worst part is finding a restaurant and then realizing you'll never be able to find it again.
Just one final question, if I could, Colm, particularly on the Death in Venice aspect of things. Mann was just 36 when he wrote that novel. It is quite extraordinary because it sounds like the words of an old man, you know, and the decay and that end of life aspect that's very much part of the story. Extraordinary that he had that facility so young.
He published his first novel, Buddenbrooks, really huge book about the decline of his family when he was 25, which means he finished when he was 24. So, yes, he had elements in him. I mean, he was very buttoned up, so that really by the time he was 36, he was the father of four children and a very famous writer. So that, I mean, he was one of those figures who would appear in a four-piece suit. you know, so that 36 then was different than 36 now.
I guess as you describe him there, it's very easy to see why you would be referring to him as the magician in your upcoming novel. Have you taken a specific point in... So go ahead.
His wife's uncle went absolutely nuts when the book appeared and said, like, for a father of four, this is a ridiculous, this book is an immoral book. So he did get into bits of trouble, but no one realized how autobiographical it was until his wife's memoirs appeared, as I say, written in her 90s.
And how has that, you know, that reaction, and perhaps, you know, some people are disturbed, understandably, by aspects of that ogling at the young boy. Has that, you know, harmed the novel in any way in its reception throughout the years, do you think?
No, it hasn't. It's strange that Death in Venice has got away with murder. You know, that if you look at it very closely, it really is a book that I don't think, if you publish now, it would be received with any great joy in the community. And I suppose it shares that with Lolita as being two books that were written in full confidence in a high literary style for a literary audience. But when we read them now, we do see that certainly attitudes and times have changed. And I don't think either of those books would be welcomed or would be just received as literary texts in the same way as they were.
Finally, then, on The Magician, on the upcoming novel, you put the Master was a little bit ahead of James's great period in terms of where you set it. Where are we at in The Magician in terms of Mann's work?
Oh, unfortunately, it's the whole business. It's from the very beginning, from him as a 3 or 4 year old watching his mother dressing up to go to a party, to the very end of his life when he's back in Lübeck, where his family was from. He's getting freedom of the city. He's 80 years old. And he's going back. Of course, the city is still bombed out. You know, in other words, they didn't reconstruct some of it. And the very buildings where he'd written about in his novel were very badly bombed in a very intense bombing of Lübeck, which, of course, was an important strategic city. So, it goes through the whole life. I'm afraid it's a long book.
Well, no need to be afraid and no need to say unfortunately on that account at all, I think. Thanks very much for sharing your thoughts on Venice Books with us this evening. That's Colm Tobin. And the books of Venice that Colm recommends you take a look at are The Wings of the Dove by Henry James, Death in Venice by Thomas Mann, and The Comfort of Strangers by Ian McEwan. Next Monday, we're off to Paris by book in the company of Sophie Gorman. 25 minutes to 8 on Monday night's Arena. The film With Neil and I, about two struggling actors, is set in late 1960s London. Wasn't a box office hit when it came out in 1987. In fact, it only had a small release and didn't even get great reviews from the critics at the time. But in the years that followed, With Neil and I came to define the term cult movie. During lockdown, one of its stars, Richard E. Grant, has been posting daily with Neil and I isolation videos of quotes from the film on Twitter, and its other star, Paul McGann, is reminded of these quotes on a regular basis, I'd say, with or without Twitter and with or without lockdown. John Maguire is joining us this evening to take a look at why this tale of two damaged friends who, quote, go on holiday by mistake, has stood the test of time. Just for those who, you know, oh yeah, I've often heard of that With Neil and I film, must sit down and watch it sometime. That's the potted version, isn't it? Two struggling actors go on holidays by accident.
In a nutshell, really, Sean. It was, like you say, a low-budget comedy made in 1986, set in London and briefly in Cumbria in 1969, right at the end of the hippie dream. The plot is basic, the mood is dark, the characters are quite obviously damaged and deranged. The overriding senses of emotionally arrested men living in squalor, unfulfilled potential, gloom, loss, unemployment, inevitable sad endings. It's hardly a comedy at all in synopsis. And in fact, there wasn't a single instance of laughter scripted for any of the characters throughout the Bruce Robinson screenplay.
Yeah, Bruce Robinson...
More than that... Sorry, go ahead, Sean. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I heard him in the documentary I was looking at earlier on today, where he basically said, it is kind of my story, really. It's the story of the flat they lived in Camden.
That's exactly it. At the time, in the mid-60s, Robinson had just graduated from the Central School of in London, an acting school, with a couple of other friends. And he was living in a squat in Camden Town, where, you know, With Neil and I being Marwood. Now, he's never referred to as Marwood in the screenplay, but we call him Marwood from the novelization, because after a few experiences as a young actor, some of which would go on to inform his story for With Neil and I, Robinson more or less gave up on acting and started to write. And the first thing he wrote was a novel, With Neil and I. Years later, after he had written his first screenplay, in fact, for The Killing Fields, which was nominated for an Oscar in 1984, he started to adapt his old novel into a screenplay. And it took a long time for anybody to pay any attention to it. He was a first-time director. The production company was George Harrison's Handmade Films, and they put up £1.1 million, which even then in the mid-1980s was a tiny amount of money.
Yeah.
But Handmade hated the film and they weren't shy about saying so. So the director, Robinson, threatened to resign on the very first day of shooting. The test screenings afterwards were a disaster. They bussed in a load of German exchange students who didn't understand a word, didn't laugh once. Total disaster. It took more than a year for the film to find a distributor. And like he said, even on its eventual release, it disappeared from cinemas within weeks and nobody seemed to get it. But 33 years later, here we are talking about it.
Yeah.
It is a timeless comedy, a classic of the form, that has engendered a cult like few others. And for me personally, it's an eternal delight.
Yeah.
And it's beloved by certain sections of the population, students, former students, anyone who ever went on holidays by mistake. Some of the fans can recite the entire 100-minute script off by heart. Some play a very ill-advised drinking game while they're watching it with cider, gin, lighter fluid, Camberwell carrots, and all. And
well, let's see where that lighter fuel reference comes from, and it gives us a sense of the kind of life they have in London before they head off up the country, or over the country, or down the country, whatever way direction it is, to Cumbria in England. With Neil, he's beginning to despair at this point in the flat. It's so cold, and of course there is no alcohol, which is hugely problematic. He decides to try lighter fuel. Richard E. Grant as With Neil, Paul McGann as I, and I'll say it now, before any of the clips, practically impossible to find a section of With Neil and I where there isn't strong language, and there is here.
Have you been at the controls?
What are you talking about?
The thermostats. What have you done to them?
I haven't touched them.
Then why has my head gone numb? I must have some booze. I demand to have some booze!
I wouldn't drink that if I was you.
Why not?
Because I don't advise it. Even the wankers on the site wouldn't drink that. That's worse than meth.
Nonsense. This is a far superior drink to meths. The wankers don't drink it because they can't afford it. Have we got any more? Liar. What's in your toolbox?
We have nothing. Sit down.
Liar. You've got antifreeze.
You bloody fool. You should never mix your drinks.
There we go. Richard E. Grant as Whiffnil. Yeah, you certainly shouldn't. Well, you probably shouldn't use lighter fuel mixed or not mixed, let's be honest. And Paul McGann.
Don't try this at home.
Joe McGuire speaking to us this evening about Whiffnil and I in the light of lockdown, and Richard E. Grant's tweets about quotable lines from the film, which he's been using in the recent past. How big, how small is really the reality? They were practically unknown, both Richard E. Grant and Paul McGann. Was this their first job kind of thing?
Their first jobs. Yeah, Grant had come from Swaziland in Africa to London to study, and had, I think he had done one piece of improvised theatre that was filmed and released on TV on Channel 4, and he had a very small part in it. So he was virtually an unknown. And McGann had come up through repertory theatre and was slightly better known, but had again never made a film. None of them knew what they were doing, basically, Sean. And that's part of the glory of it, is that the magic in Whiffnil and I is that looseness, that fearlessness. They had this wonderful, wonderful script, the paragon of British screenwriting at that time. They had a great central idea. It's basically the first film that pops into my head when I think of a film about friendship. It is a film that is devoted to their friendship. And they had that, and they had very little else, and they still managed to pull something extraordinary together. But whereas McGann went on to a decent career, including a stint as Doctor Who on TV, the film launched Grant as a superstar Hollywood actor, even if he's never really left Whiffnil behind, and having spent, like you say, the intervening three decades, being ambushed by fans quoting lines at him, and like the social media videos that he's done over the last 2 months, giving us all a laugh. And he wrote a great book about the entire experience called With Nails, which is a diary of the production. And it's hilarious on every page. He's a wonderful writer himself.
I wonder how often he gets that laugh thrown back at him, or indeed how often he has to do that laugh.
I'd say every line of it. Yeah. This is the problem with cult film, Sean. Now, I love this film dearly, and it's very dear to my heart. It's a film that about friendship that I think of when I think of the friends that I had when I first watched it, still friends, lifelong friends, in the early 1990s on a battered VHS that we wore out, that was taped off the TV off Channel 4, showed it in the early 1990s. And we must have watched it 30 or 40 times. And those are very powerful emotions. And the experience of watching the film endures because amongst all the laughs and all the crazy things that they do, there is this genuine, unforgettably authentic and unmistakably authentic friendship between the two of them that Robinson managed to capture so well.
Yeah, that friendship is a huge theme. In fact, it was a friend of Robinson's own. I think that was the big model for the Whiffnil character. But let me get you to talk a little bit as well about this trip to Cumbria. Obviously, they're going from, you know, urban London into rural Cumbria. Do you think was there some serious point being made there around rural urban differences or anything like that, or is it just a chance for fun?
Very much so. One of the keys to why Whiffnil and I is funny in the first place, and why it's still funny, is the precision of the positioning in the screenplay. And of course, the funny language, the funny dialogue, and the actors' deliveries of every precious word. But it's a series of clashes. I recall Robinson described it as the plot of the film, now it's barely a plot, as chasing a man up a tree, throwing stones at him and allowing him to come down in his own time. And the clashes that he sets up and the poetry that he finds in those conflicts, city versus country, wealthy versus not wealthy, drunk versus sober, the old establishment versus the new guard, the hippies versus the squares. There's a series of direct confrontations that Robinson puts forward, some of which are more subtle than others, some of which aren't subtle at all.
Well, let me give you a choice.
That's the key to this constant 100-minute argument, basically, that they're having throughout.
Well, let me give you a choice of one of those confrontations, because I won't be able to play both of them. Do you want Whiffnil and I with the farmer, or do you want Whiffnil and
farmer.
I in the cake shop with the farmer? You want them
the farmer, I think, the farmer.
Okay, well, let's listen then. They're on holiday by mistake, as we said, Richard E. Grant, Paul McGann, Whiffnil and I, and they flag down a local farmer for assistance. Yes, there's strong language here too.
Stop, please! Please, stop! Please, stop!
Are you the farmer?
Shut up! I'll deal with this.
We've gone on holiday by mistake. We're in this cottage here. Are you the farmer?
Stop saying that, Withnall! Of course he's the fucking farmer! We're friends of Montague Withnall. We desperately need fuel and wood. Montague Withnall. You must know him. Fat man owns the cottage.
Ah, say the fat man. London type, queer sort. Think his name's French or something.
French?
Aye, Adrien de la Toche. He ain't been here for a couple of years. Last time I saw him, he was with his son.
Yeah, that's him.
Listen, we're bona fide. We're not from London. Could we have some fuel and wood?
I could bring you some logs up later, but I've got the cows and that to feed first.
Well,
shut up! That would be very kind of you. What about food? Do you think you could sell us something to eat?
I could bring you a chicken, but you'll have to go to the village, really.
That would be very kind of you. Mr.
Parker?
Mr. Park. What happened to your leg?
Got a Randy Bull up there. Give me what it need.
There we go.
Every Michael line, Wardle, every word.
Yeah, Michael Wardle, I think, is the character of Isaac Park in there, the farmer, and of course McGann and Grant there as well in that scene from Withnall. And is it just lines like that? There's so many of them that makes it so quotable.
It is that, and it's also the delivery from the actors themselves, the passion that they put into it, and the awful situations that they find themselves in. Then all they can do is try to talk their way out of it and try to talk to one another. There is a series of spiritual crises that they have to go through, and in that Robinson puts this elegy to youth and to coming of age and this tender, sad separation that we come to towards the end. But these aren't teenagers. There's a line where Withnall says that he's almost 30, and they're so arrested in their squalor that they don't recognise the end of an era when it comes. You need the character of Danny the drug dealer, played memorably by Ralph Brown, who says to them, you know, they're selling hippie wigs in Woolworths. It's the commodification of all the cultural, counter-cultural ideals that they had.
Okay.
And between the tabloid headlines and the swinging wrecking ball and these pointless and painful interactions with the old guard that they keep bumping into. The
One
malignant
final question.
Effects of that. Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
One final question, John, because it's a thing about cult movies and, you know, not everybody likes every cult movie. Is Withnall and I just a cult movie, or is it a good movie as well?
Well, for me, it's a classic. It is a cult film, but it's become more than that. It was lost almost and forgotten and rediscovered by TV and VHS. But if you think of the context of it in 1987... there were several big screen adaptations of explorations of this quintessentially male friendship, English male friendship. J.L. Carr's A Month in the Country was filmed. E.M. Foster's Morris was filmed. There was the Joe Orton biopic Prick Up Your Ears, all of which considered the promise of youth corrupted by the intrusions of the real world, the end of innocence and squandered potential, just like Withnall and I does. Can anybody remember any of those other films? So, yes, it's a classic. Yes, it has endured for 33 years and 33 years to come, because the things that are in it are timeless. The emotion that it contains is timeless, and the feelings that Robinson can engender. Now, poor Robinson never did anything really else since.
All right.
Okay. That's a shame, but...
Yeah. There you go. Well, you believe it's a classic. Some believe it's a cult movie. I think I know which side I'm on. John McGuire there with Neil and I, available to watch on Channel 4 on demand, in fact, for the next 2 weeks. And if you go to channel4.com, you'll find all the details. The Welcoming Project was launched in 2016 by choreographer Catherine Young. The aim of the project is to use the medium of dance to foster cultural integration, social inclusion between people of all ethnic backgrounds now living in Ireland. This Wednesday, the Welcoming Project will run a once-off online dance class with dancer and teaching artist Yahya Kamate. The class will be entitled Dance in Solidarity and is aimed at showing solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. Yahya Kamate is originally from the Ivory Coast. These days he's based in New York. That's where he joins me from this evening. And Catherine Young, I think, is here at home in Ireland. Yahya, first of all, maybe you could tell me a little bit about your own journey. Was dance a big part of your life growing up on the Ivory Coast or in the Ivory Coast?
Oh, yeah, definitely. After finishing high school, I went to a dance school and studied dance. I was able to join the National Ballet, the national dance team of the country, and worked with them for a while, went to Europe, came back to the Ivory Coast. Then in 1994, I came to the United States to honor my country. There was a festival, Memphis in May, that I was, aware of. Then we came here and we performed. Then after that, I stayed in the United States because people liked what I was doing. So I joined the school system. It was very easiest way for me to really, really create a nice platform. So with African dancing and drumming, school from K to 12 graders is what I've been doing for the past 26 years.
And the Ivory Coast is a republic in Western Africa between Ghana and Liberia. Do you have specific forms of dance separate from those of your surrounding nations?
You can see in Ivory Coast, people who migrate from Liberia live in Ivory Coast. People who migrate from Ghana live in Ivory Coast. So we have about five tribes with different countries that we are surrounded with, like Burkina Faso, Mali, Guinea, Ghana, and Liberia. All these countries have people originated from that country, migrated from that country to the Ivory Coast. So we have a lot of things similar that we do together. The Mande tribe is speaking from Liberia all the way down to Sierra Leone, and you can hear it in Ivory Coast. If you go to Ghana, you can hear the Akan tribe speaking. When you go to Guinea, Mali, and Burkina Faso, you will hear the Mandingo tribe. The language is called Mandinka, and it's also speaking in Ivory Coast. So a lot of stuff that we do in Ivory Coast has something to do with different countries around the country.
Then I come to you now, Catherine Young, and you're in Kerry, in fact, this evening, I understand. Now, you initiated the Welcoming Project back in 2016, Catherine, what exactly was the aim? I think I've touched on it in the introduction.
Yeah, I lived in San Francisco for a long time, and when I came back to Ireland, I was living in Kerry, and it was just very hard to get to know people from other countries, and I knew that they were here, and especially the direct provision system, there was a few in Kerry. So the idea was to try and bring people together to dance. You know, it's non-verbal, and to invite people in from all walks of life to share their own dance styles and I guess learn from each other. So yeah, it's been going for 4 years now, and we've done it in mostly in Kerry, but also this year in Limerick and Clare and Dublin and Longford. So yeah, the idea is it's through dance to people to come together.
And Yahya was mentioning there about his own background in the Ivory Coast. You visited Africa at one point along, but that's not where you and Yahya hooked up.
Yeah, no, I've been to Africa a couple of times. I study West African dance myself, and I was over in New York last year taking class at the Ailey Extension, and I met Yaya there. He's a drum and dance teacher, a wonderful teacher. So we kind of thought it'd be lovely, you know, for this event on Wednesday to show, like, you know, my background as an African dance and to show solidarity between kind of the Black Lives Matter over there and in Ireland. So we thought it'd be lovely to invite him to dance with our community and bring them both together.
And so, Yahya, you'll be giving this class this Wednesday online. Is that how everything is happening in New York, really, at the moment as well, in terms of dance? Are you working online, essentially?
Oh, yeah, essentially, definitely. Virtually studying is it's a must right now. I teach in high schools and a couple lower schools and also some private schools, dance and drumming school that I'm working with. But here also, you know, people are moving around, doing, you know, protesting. I think this is a different way to do it, and it's also powerful. You don't even have to be together to manifest, to protest. It's a different kind of energy. It's a mindset energy, and I think we will be able to put this together.
And to what level of danceability would you need to have to be part of this class on Wednesday? Maybe Catherine, you could take that.
Yeah, it's open to all. But yeah, it's open to all. The level is going to be open to. It's not an advanced class. It's the idea is to bring people together. So the level will be anybody that wants to participate. They can come and dance in their living room and show solidarity that way. So it won't be. I've told you not to give a hard class. So it'll be really accessible to all. And the idea is really that we can have a bit of fun and be in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in the US and in Ireland.
Yeah, not to give a hard class, Yahya, but I'm guessing that you're not going. It's not going to be very easy either. We'll need to stretch and work ourselves a little bit.
Yeah, especially when people are coming together to show solidarity, they want to show strength. So we're going to have to make maybe do a little more challenging for them to get one or two steps there. But it will be fun after all. It will definitely be fun.
And Catherine had mentioned there too that you, a drumming background within the dance. Will you have drumming music there? Will you have drummers playing? Or what's the plan in terms of what those who are taking the class might be listening to?
Definitely. Yeah. The drummers will be social distancing with me. They will be in the background as I'm in the forefront teaching the class. And it's going to be like a live performance. I mean, live drumming and dancing. You know, there's maybe 2 seconds or 3 seconds delayed in while using Zoom, but that should not affect what we're doing. And I think I've been doing this for the past 3 or 4 months now since we are here in quarantine in the United States. I have a great experience, and I think it's going to be fantastic.
Well, listen, good luck with it all. And I should say that all donations, and is it just you make a donation? There's no set fee, Catherine. You make a donation on the for the class.
Yeah, the class is free, and then if people feel compelled to give, we'd be splitting the money between the Black Lives Matter over in the US and to charities here at Massey that support asylum seekers and
All right. Well, listen, best of luck with the class. And if you want to find out more detail about what Catherine Young and Yahya Kamati have been talking about, that once-off dance class in support of Black Lives Matter movement, it's been run by the Welcoming Project in Kerry. Full details of the event on catherineyoungdance.com. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Great to be back. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.